We're going to talk about the Spinal Trauma General Principles chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia, www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayette. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. So spinal trauma, it's definitely one of those really high stakes situations in medicine, you know?
Absolutely. Everything can change in an instant, and understanding what's going on inside that spine is just critical.
Right. And today we're not getting into specific fractures or, you know, the nitty gritty of surgery just yet. We're focusing purely on the fundamentals, the general principles straight from that Orthopedia chapter.
Which is exactly where you need to start. You can't make sense of the injuries without knowing the basic blueprint, the bones, the ligaments, the nerves.
Okay. So our mission here is to walk through those core concepts, kind of step by step, hitting the key questions from the chapter to build that solid foundation. Let's start with the bones themselves. How's this whole column built?
Well, you've got the main stack, right? 24 individual vertebrae before you hit the fused sacrum and coccyx.
And those break down into regions.
Yeah, the familiar ones. 7 cervical up in the neck, 12 thoracic where the ribs attach, and 5 lumbar in the lower back.
But the first two, C1 and C2, they're kind of special, aren't they?
Oh, completely different. The atlas, C1, it's almost like a washer or a ring. It doesn't really have that big blocky body like the others. Or a spinous process sticking out the back. It's mostly those lateral masses connected by arches.
Okay, like a ring. And C2.
C2, the axis, is the one with that prominent bony projection sticking upwards the odontoid process, or dens. It fits right up into the ring of C1.
Ah, so that's the pivot point.
Exactly. That C1, C2 joint, the lanoaxial joint, that peg in a ring setup. That's what gives you most of your head rotation, maybe 50 degrees or so each way.
Which is great for looking around, but I guess that unique structure makes it vulnerable too.
It does. It allows for great mobility, but you see specific injuries there that just don't happen lower down in the more typical vertebrae.
Okay, so bones are one part, but what holds it all together? The soft tissues must be crucial.
Absolutely essential. Think ligaments. You've got these really strong bands running up and down. The anterior longitudinal ligament, or ALL, is on the front of the vertebral bodies, and the PLL, the posterior longitudinal ligament, is on the back of the bodies, inside the canal.
Right. And there are others.
Oh, yeah. Between the lamina posteriorly and the canal, you have the ligamentum flavum, kind of yellowish, elastic.
Yeah.
Then connecting the spinous processes, you have the interspinal ligaments, and between the transverse processes, the intertransverse ligaments, sort of like webbing holding the bony parts.
And don't forget the discs.
Can't forget the discs, those intervertebral cushions between the bodies. Super important.
Okay, so within this bony ligamentous tunnel runs the main event, the spinal cord.
Precisely. It travels down from the brainstem through the foramen magnum at the base of the skull, but it actually ends relatively high up, usually around the level of the first lumbar vertebra, L1.
So the cord itself doesn't go all the way down the spine?
Nope. The canal it sits in is bordered by the vertebral body in front, the pedicles on the sides, and the lamina behind.
And nerves branch off along the way.
At each level, yeah. Nerve roots come off dorsal, and vessel roots join up and then exit out the sides through those little openings, the neuroformina.
So what's below L1 in the canal then if the cord stops?
Ah, that's where you find the cauda equina. Yep. The cord tapers down into the canis medullaris, and then below that it's just this collection of nerve roots continuing downwards before they exit lower down. It looks like a horse's tail, hence the name.
Cauda equina, right.
And one other critical thing, especially up in the neck, the vertebral arteries. They actually run up through little holes in the transverse processes of the cervical vertebrae.
Wow. Inside the bone.
Yep. Which means a C-spine fracture or dislocation can potentially injure those arteries, too.
Yeah.
It's all packed in there pretty tight.
It really is. Okay, so knowing all that anatomy, how does it help us understand why injuries happen in certain places more than others?
It's all about regional differences in, well, mobility versus stability. Take the thoracic spine, say T1 down to T10.
That feels pretty stiff.
Exactly. Because the ribs attach there, forming the rib cage, it creates this really stable, almost rigid unit. So you need a lot of force to injure that segment usually.
Okay. Protected by the ribs, but other areas aren't so lucky.
Right. Contrast that with the thoracolumbar junction around T11, T12, L1, L2. That's a really common spot for fractures and dislocations.
Why there specifically?
Because you're transitioning from that rigid rib-supported thoracic spine to the much more flexible lumbar spine. That change in mechanics creates a stress riser, like a hinge point.
Makes sense, like bending something right at the joint.
Precisely. And you see this pattern in other transition zones too, where the skull meets the neck, occipitocervical, where the neck meets the thoracic spine,
yeah.
supracothoracic, and down where the lumbar spine meets the sacrum, lumbosacral, mobility increases, stability decreases, and bang, higher risk of injury.
That link between anatomy and injury pattern is, yeah, that's fundamental. Okay, let's shift to the consequences. How do we figure out the level of function after a spinal cord injury?
That comes down to the neurological exam. A really careful motor and sensory assessment, you're testing specific muscle groups and specific skin areas, level by level.
Can you give us some key examples? Like, what functions tell you about specific levels?
Sure. These are sort of benchmarks we use all the time. C5 function is largely elbow flexion, bending your elbow in sensation over the side of the shoulder.
Okay.
C6 is key for wrist extension, pulling your wrist back, and sensation on the thumb and index finger area. C7 is elbow extension, straightening your arm, your triceps, and sensation on the middle finger.
Triceps at C7, got it.
C8 is more about finger flexion, making a fist, and sensation on the ring and pinky fingers. T1 powers the small intrinsic muscles of the hand, like spreading your fingers, and gives sensation on the inner forearm.
And lower down in the legs?
Lower down, yeah. L2 is for hip flexion, lifting your knee up. Sensation is mid-anterior thigh. L3 is knee extension, straightening your knee, sensation over the front of the knee. L4 is ankle dorsiflexion, pulling your foot up, sensation medial leg.
Okay.
L5 is typically tested by extending the big toe, lifting it up, sensation more on the top of the foot. And S1 is ankle plantar flexion, pushing your foot down like pressing a gas pedal, and sensation on the outside or bottom of the foot.
Wow, okay. So you test all those, and the lowest level that's essentially normal tells you the neurological level of injury.
Basically, yes. And the rule is pretty stark.
Yeah.
The higher up the injury, the more function is lost.
And functionally, that translates directly to daily life.
Massively. Think about it.
Yeah.
Having C6 function means you can extend your wrist, maybe use adaptive devices to feed yourself. But if you have C7 function, now you have triceps power. That often means you can push a manual wheelchair, do independent transfers from chair to bed. It's a huge difference.
Oh, incredible.
And having T1 means you have hand intrinsics, crucial for dexterity. Lumbar injuries obviously impact leg function, walking, and often bowel and bladder control.
That functional mapping is so critical. Now, you hear about injuries being complete or incomplete. What's the difference?
That's a fundamental distinction.
Yeah.
An incomplete injury means there's some nerve function, either voluntary movement or sensation, preserved below the actual level of the spinal cord damage. The key is, any preserved function counts, especially sensation in the perianal area around the anus. That's S4, S5 function.
Okay, so any sparing makes it incomplete. What's complete then?
Complete means there is a total absence of both voluntary motor and sensory function below the level of the injury, including those lowest sacral segments.
But there's a catch, right? You can't always tell immediately.
Exactly. That spinal shock. Right after the injury, the cord can kind of shut down temporarily. You get this flaccid paralysis and loss of reflexes below the injury level, even if the cord isn't permanently completely damaged.
So you have to wait for that to wear off. How long does that take?
It could be hours, sometimes days. You can only definitively classify an injury as complete after spinal shock resolves.
And how do you know it's resolved?
The clinical sign we look for is the return of the bulbo cavernosus reflex, the spinal cord reflex. If you say, gently tug on a Foley catheter or squeeze the gland's penis, you should get a reflex contraction of the anal sphincter. Once that reflex is back, spinal shock is over.
Okay, then you can assess for complete versus incomplete, and that's where the ASIA scale fits in.
Precisely. The American Spinal Injury Association Impairment Scale, or ASIA scale, standardizes this. Grade K is complete. No motor or sensory function preserved in the sacral segments S4, S5.
Got it.
Grade B is sensory incomplete. There's sensation below the level, including S4, S5, but no motor function preserved more than 3 levels below the motor level. Grade C is motor incomplete motor function is preserved below the level, but most key muscles below the level are weak, less than grade 3 strength.
Grade 3 being movement against gravity.
Right. Grade D is also motor incomplete, but stronger, at least half the key muscles below the level are grade 3 or better. And grade E is normal motor and sensory function.
That gives a much clearer picture of the severity.
We have been talking about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook Orthopedia at www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Penny, and Vayet. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Okay, picking back up. Within those incomplete injuries, ASIA, B, C, and D, there are sometimes specific patterns, right? These cord syndromes. Central cord is mentioned as the most common.
That's the one. central cord syndrome. You typically see this in older individuals, often after a fall where they hit their chin, causing a hyperextension injury to the neck, especially if they already have some arthritis or narrowing of the spinal canal, cervical stenosis.
And what happens inside the cord?
It's thought to be mainly a contusion, a bruise, affecting the central part of the cord more than the periphery. It particularly hits the fibers in the lateral columns that control the arms and hands.
So the symptoms reflect that?
They do. The classic picture is weakness that's much worse in the arms and hands than in the legs. Fine motor control in the hands is often significantly affected. Sometimes they call it man-in-a-barrel syndrome because the arms are weak, but the legs might be relatively okay. Bladder dysfunction is common too.
Okay, arms worse than legs. What about anterior cord syndrome?
Anterior cord is different. It's usually caused by damage to the front part of the spinal cord. This might be direct compression from, say, a bone fragment or a herniated disc, or crucially, damage to the anterior spinal artery, which supplies blood to the front two-thirds of the cord.
So lack of blood flow.
Can be, yeah.
Yeah.
Ischemia. This knocks out the motor pathways, corticospinal tracts, and the pain and temperature pathways, spinothalamic tracts, because they run in the front part of the cord.
Leading to what clinically?
Complete paralysis below the level of the injury, loss of pain and temperature sensation below the level.
But something is spared.
Yes, because the posterior columns, which carry light touch, vibration, and position sense, proprioception, are usually okay. Those sensations are preserved. So they can feel touch, but not pinprick or hot cold, and they can't move. You might also see low blood pressure, hypotension from autonomic involvement.
And the prognosis.
Unfortunately, anterior cord syndrome generally has the worst prognosis for motor recovery among the incomplete syndromes. Maybe only 10-15% regain really useful function.
Wow, quite grim. Okay, the last one mentioned is Brown-Séquard syndrome.
Brown-Séquard. This one results from damage to just one side of the spinal cord, a hemisection. Think penetrating trauma, like a knife wound, is a common cause.
So half the cord is injured. How does that present? It sounds like it would be strange.
It is a very distinct pattern, yeah. Because different nerve tracts cross over at different levels. You end up with loss of motor function, vibration, and proprioception on the same side as the injury, ipsilateral. But you lose pain and temperature sensation on the opposite side, contralateral, below the lesion.
Huh. Motor loss on one side, pain temp loss on the other.
Exactly. The motor tracts cross high up in the brainstem. But the pain temp tracts cross almost immediately upon entering the cord. So a one-sided cord lesion catches them differently.
That's fascinating. And the prognosis here?
Actually, Brown-Séquard generally has the best prognosis for functional recovery among these incomplete syndromes. Many patients regain significant function, including the ability to walk.
Good to know there's often better potential there. Okay, shifting from the clinical picture to how we see it imaging. Absolutely crucial, I assume.
Non-negotiable. And for looking at the bones in trauma, CT scanning is really the standard now.
So CT over plain x-rays for fractures.
Oh, definitely. Much better detail, much higher sensitivity. CT is fantastic for seeing fractures, even small ones, understanding the fracture pattern and seeing if the spinal canal is narrowed by bone fragments. It's less good for seeing the cord itself, though.
What about plain x-rays then? Are they still used?
They still have a role. Sometimes for quick initial overview, checking general alignment. And importantly, for dynamic views, flexion and extension x-rays in an awake, cooperative patient where you suspect ligament instability that isn't obvious on static films. Also for special views, like the open mouth view for the odontoid process of C2. But for primary fracture detection, CT is the workhorse.
So if CT is the bone expert, MRI is for?
MRI is the soft tissue expert. It's indispensable for looking directly at the spinal cord, the ligaments, the discs, and detecting things like epidural hematomas, blood clots pressing on the cord.
So when do you absolutely need an MRI?
Well, certainly if the patient has any neurological deficit, or if the CT or x-rays show findings suspicious for ligament injury, like a vertebra slipped forward, spondylolisthesis, or funny spacing between bones. Also, if you're worried about a disc herniation caused by the trauma or an occult fracture, CT might have missed. And it's key for looking at the cord itself for bruising, swelling, or actual tearing. Oh, and in patients who are unconscious or can't cooperate for flexion extension x-rays, MRI is the best way to evaluate for cervical instability.
Sounds like you often end up needing both then.
Very frequently, yes. CT gives you the bony architecture. MRI gives you the neural elements and soft tissues. They provide complementary, crucial information.
Okay, once you have the diagnosis, what are the general treatment options?
Broadly, it's non-operative, operative, and medical management. Non-operative treatment is all about immobilization, holding the spine still, to allow healing or prevent further injury.
Using braces and collars.
Exactly. Things like a Philadelphia collar or other rigid cervical orthoses for the neck, a TLSO, that clamshell-like brace, or a corset for the thoracic or lumbar spine. And for really rigid immobilization of the upper C-spine, the halo vest.
Ah, yes, the halo. That looks pretty serious.
It is. It involves inserting pins directly into the outer table of the skull, usually four of them, which connect to a metal ring. That ring is then attached via post to a vest worn around the chest. It provides excellent stability for certain unstable upper cervical injuries.
And if non-operative isn't enough, or there's compression...
Surgery. Then surgery comes into play. The main goals are usually twofold. First, decompression. That means removing whatever is pressing on the spinal cord or nerve roots, maybe bone fragments, a disc, or a hematoma.
Making space for the nerves.
Right. And the second goal is stabilization. If the spine is unstable due to the injury, you need to fix it internally to prevent movement and allow fusion.
How is that done typically?
Usually with spinal fusion, using instrumentation like screws, rods, plates, sometimes wires, to bridge the injured segment and hold it rigidly. Often, bone graft is added to encourage the vertebrae to actually grow together into one solid piece over time.
And there's immediate medical stuff too, right? Besides the bracing or surgery.
Oh, absolutely critical. Preventing secondary injury is key. That means things like DVT prophylaxis, preventing blood clots in the legs, because these patients are often immobile. And maintaining adequate blood pressure, sometimes using IV fluids or vasopressor medications, is vital to ensure good blood flow to the injured spinal cord.
What about steroids? You used to hear a lot about high-dose steroids for spinal cord injury.
Yeah, that's a really important topic. And the thinking has definitely evolved. For years, high-dose methylprednisolone was often given based on some earlier studies suggesting a possible small benefit.
But not anymore.
Well, more recent, larger analyses, like a big meta-analysis in neurology back in 2019, basically concluded that the evidence for neurological benefit is weak or absent, but the risks are significant. Things like increased infections, wound healing problems, gastrointestinal bleeding, especially problematic in patients with multiple injuries or open fractures.
So generally not recommended routinely now.
The pendulum has definitely swung away from routine use based on the current balance of evidence showing more harm than clear benefit.
That's a major shift. Okay, this has been a fantastic deep dive into the principles. To wrap things up, let's quickly hit those five key terms from the chapter as a summary.
Good idea. Cement the main points.
First, atlas and axis.
C1 and C2, the unique top two vertebrae. Atlas is the ring. Axis has the dens, the peg. Their special joint allows head rotation that have unique injury patterns.
She's second, level of function.
Determined by the neuroexam motor and sensory testing. Pinpoints the lowest intact spinal cord level and directly correlates with what a patient can or cannot do functionally. Remember C7 giving triceps power for independence.
Third, complete versus incomplete cord injury.
The big divide. Incomplete means any motor or sensory function, especially perianal, is spared below the lesion. Complete means none. Remember, you can only diagnose complete after spinal shock resolves, bulbocavernosus reflex returns. Agent grades A through E quantify this.
Fourth, advanced imaging for spinal trauma.
Think CT and MRI. CT is king for bone detail, finding fractures. MRI is essential for the soft tissues, the cord itself, ligaments, discs, hematomas. Often need both for the full picture, especially with neurodeficits.
And number five, decompression and fusion.
The main goals of surgery when it's needed. Decompression relieves pressure on the nerves. Fusion stabilizes the injured spinal segment, usually with hardware and bone graft, to prevent harmful movement and promote healing.
Excellent summary. Going through these principles really underscores how complex spinal trauma is, but also how systematic approach based on this knowledge is absolutely vital.
It really does. And maybe a final thought for listeners, consider the incredible plasticity and potential for recovery that still exists, particularly with incomplete injuries. Understanding these principles isn't just about diagnosis. It's the foundation for guiding rehabilitation and maximizing that potential, even after devastating trauma.
We have just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia by Bernstein, Penny, and Mayette. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, before you take a test and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. You'll be glad you did.